So enter one of those objects, a 4,000-year-old clay tablet written in an ancient script called cuneiform. It turned up at the British Museum recently and made its way to curator Irving Finkel, who just happens to be one of the few people in the world who could read it. And here's the thing. This dusty, pre-biblical piece of clay turns out to be a recipe for building an ark. Irving, let's start with the basics. What does this thing look like?
Well, okay, it's kind of brown. It's about the size of a mobile phone, and it's made of clay. Now, let's imagine this. You have a piece of clay, that shape, size of a mobile phone, brown, unbaked, on the floor. You get a chicken. You make the chicken drunk. And then you put the chicken on the tablet and allow it to dance to a 78 record. Then you have something which looks exactly like a cuneiform tablet.
Well, so for those of us who don't know anything about cuneiform, give us a little tiny primer. What's wonderful about it?
Well, the ancient Sumerians and Babylonians who lived in what we call Iraq, but what is anciently called Mesopotamia, these were the people who used cuneiform writing as their normal writing system. And they did it for about 3,000 years. They lived in a country where the riverbanks were lined with extremely high-quality clay, which could be used for a myriad of purposes. So when the first experiments in making marks, which would enable people to recapture the sounds of the words that they wanted to communicate, they naturally turned to clay as a writing material.
So they just kind of engraved on the clay, drew on it with a stick or something?
They kind of printed. They wrote with a stick, a bit like a chopstick. And all the cuneiform signs, of which there are many hundreds, when you know how they work and what their sounds are, if you pronounce them one by one, you suddenly find the words leap out and you can hear the voice with these ancient sentences.
Well, into this story comes, in the present day, a single tablet with ancient cuneiform writing on it. And the backstory of how this tablet even got into your hands in the first place is extraordinary.
It's quite a romantic thing, really. We have lots of these cuneiform inscriptions in the British Museum, and I'm one of the two lunatics on the staff whose job it is to read these things. But on this particular afternoon, the young chap, Simmons, his name was, Douglas Simmons, he came in with a sort of bag of bits and pieces, miscellaneous group of small antiquities. And he said to me that his dad had been a bit of a curio hunter and in the late 40s was in the Middle East and he picked up bits and pieces. Now, the other stuff on the table was quite sweet and interesting, but it wasn't anything like as important as that tablet, because that tablet turned out to be part of the Babylonian story, the Noah-type flood story, with a lot of new stuff.
But one of the points of your book is that this story predates the Bible, right? So that there's a story about a boat and a flood and a rescue in, well, how far back?
Well, it's a good millennium before the Bible, a good 1,000 years, that these old ancient peoples who lived in between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers in Mesopotamia, they also had this story. And in their world, the gods decide to destroy the ancient Mesopotamian people because they were noisy. And I see it, I can't get out of my mind this idea that the gods are sitting around after a heavy lunch, dozing in armchairs or something, and there's a tremendous noise somewhere off which keeps making them wake up. And eventually Enlil, who's the chief god, loses his temper and decides, look, I tell you, we're going to swat these mosquitoes, we're going to get rid of these, it's really annoying. And when that, afterwards we'll think about some other kind of species. But one god only, called Enki, he made up his own mind that this flood was stupid. So he found this fellow Atrahasis, the equivalent of our Noah, and he told Atrahasis, build this boat quick, fill it up with the animals, and everything will be fine. But this new piece from Douglas was something absolutely superlative, and it was the most astonishing thing in the world to read this for the first time, because the boat, the ark as we call it, they just called it the boat, was a round vessel. There was a special kind of boat, which we call a coracle, made of reeds or some such stuff and waterproofed, a round boat which was very light and was very safe because it wouldn't sink.
So this is basically like a giant basket.
So it is exactly like a giant basket. But the thing is this. In this story, what we have here is a giant coracle, but it's not a giant coracle like a storyteller would say, you know, 100 miles long and 6 miles high, or the biggest coracle you ever saw. The measurements are given for the rope out of which the basket is to be woven, and the wood to make the ribs, and the bitumen to waterproof it.
So it basically gives you instructions for building an ark?
It does. It's a bit like this. You go down to the supermarket, you get a big cardboard box to build a swing in the garden, and it has instructions on the side. You know, you should have 12 screws, one base, one seat, one chair, stuff like that. And then there's a diagram which is supposed to explain to you how to put it together. Of course, they never worked those diagrams. This didn't have a diagram, but it had all the specs.
Why would the ancient Babylonians bother to write down the specs for building an ark? Is that so somebody could build another one in the future?
That was my first question. What is this stuff doing in a story? So I tried to imagine a context in which that calculation, and actually it was rather complicated calculation, had found its way into the narrative. And I had this idea as follows. Let's say you have a storyteller who makes his living, so to speak, going from village to village. And he's got this marvellous story about the near destruction of the world. If you focus for a moment on the likely audience in such a context, where you're going to have many people who were boatmen, who were boat builders, who lived by the river, you can't say to people like that, talking about rescuing the world, just build a big boat. Because someone at the back is going to say, what did this boat look like? Some guy, beefy fellow who spends his life, what do you mean? How big was it? What does it look like? You know, how big was it? And all these kind of questions. So what does he do? I have this idea that after some evening of embarrassment, he goes around to see someone he was at school with. He said, listen, I need to know, if we had a coracle that was this big, how much rope, can you work it out? You know, so probably the guy said, are you kidding me? So he'd go to the school, and then the teacher might get someone who made these, but maybe they'd have to do a lot of work. But in the end, they came up with the exact measurements. And then, so I think, well, I can imagine this guy goes into some village sometime, and he's, you know, they get to the pin about, can you tell us a, I can certainly tell you about this boat. Now, let me be exact about it. The ground plan measures 3,600 square metres. The walls are 7 metres high. The amount of rope required is this, and so forth. And if anybody asked him this question, out it would come to defend his narrative.
Do you conclude from this, then, that Noah's Ark never existed? Because, you know, there are archaeologists still hunting for it on the slopes of Mount Ararat.
I know there, and I feel sympathetic towards them, but I don't believe Noah's Ark really existed, or the Babylonian one. I think there were real floods. I think in Mesopotamia there was once a disastrous flood, very, very ancient times, which left people with a residual fear that one day this tsunami could come back. And I think that the story of the Ark and the rescue of livestock is something which was created and became part of their mythology as the answer to that fear, with this point, that if the gods ever decided again that they were going to do this, there would always be some little rescue that meant life would go on. I think that's the relationship between them. In the Middle East, there must have been a massive destructive flood, and that generated the story in which escape by this special boat was the only answer.
Irving Finkel's book is called The Ark Before Noah, and he has one of the best job titles we've ever seen. He's the assistant keeper of ancient Mesopotamian script, language, and cultures at the British Museum, and curator in charge of cuneiform inscriptions on tablets of clay from ancient Mesopotamia.